Hello, in tonight's Quantum Leap, the intriguing connection between submarines, some classic rock music and prospecting for water, plus election campaigning online and where to go whale watching this weekend. But we begin with some very unusual worms in California. Now, neuroscientists working in Stanford University have genetically engineered some simple nematode worms so that they now incorporate a light switch. And that means that simply by shining light on the worms, the scientists can now control the worm brain cells and even their movement. That's blue light for go and yellow light for stop. Well, the research has just been reported in today's edition of the science journal Nature. It's the kind of brain control that might sound like science fiction for some of us, so why would anyone want to do it, and what possible use could it be? Well, joining me on the line is neuroscientist Professor Michael Heuser from University College London. Michael, we should say at the outset that these light switches that the Stanford scientists have genetically introduced into the worms, they're not actually mechanical switches, they're special proteins that, as I understand it, respond to light. And this, I think, then allows them to control the brain cells and switch them on and off. And so my first question is this new, being able to control brain cells so precisely, or just a new way of doing something that you neuroscientists have been doing for some time, say, with electrodes?
Well, I think it is something quite new. We've traditionally had two tools available to control brain activity. The first is using drugs, and the second is using stimulation electrodes. Now, drugs are obviously quite useful, but they suffer from a lack of specificity. It's difficult to target particular cells in the brain, and they're also quite slow in their action. So stimulation electrodes are fast, obviously, and precise temporally, but you can't select which neurons you're going to switch on. Furthermore, stimulation electrodes have the problem that you cannot actually switch off neural activity with them. You can generally only switch neural activity on. And so this new approach that's been pioneered by these new studies actually allows us to switch neurons on and off, and it also allows us to do it reversibly with millisecond precision in specific sets of neurons.
And does it mean that you can actually switch on an individual nerve cell? Is it that precise?
Theoretically, you could switch on a single nerve cell if you manage to get the light focused enough that you can actually target a single nerve cell.
What does it mean for researchers like yourself? I mean, what can you now do with this technique you couldn't do before?
One of the main advantages is that you can actually express the proteins in specific sets of cells. So, for example, we know that dopamine neurons located deep in the brain are the ones that are compromised in Parkinson's disease. And the new approach essentially allows us to selectively express these proteins in those neurons so we can manipulate their activity in a very precise and elegant way.
Is it about understanding more about how the brain works?
I think it's going to be a tremendous tool not only for helping us to understand how single cells and how circuits of neurons work, but also there's some tremendous therapeutic possibilities which are on the horizon.
Such as, you've mentioned Parkinson's disease, and I know that there are some treatments already experimentally in use where electrodes, I think, are used to control brain cells. Is that the kind of therapeutic use?
That's one possibility, that we can actually much more precisely regulate the activity of the groups of neurons that we want to regulate. There's also possibilities in that we can improve sensation. For example, there's the suggestion that these tools might be useful as a kind of neural prosthesis, for example, in people with impaired vision. There's the possibility, obviously, since these are light-activated sensors, that one could use these as ways to augment retinal function that's been compromised.
Obviously, it's one thing to genetically engineer a simple worm like a nematode. How might the technique be used in a patient with Parkinson's?
There is one major barrier to be overcome, and that's that we have to get these proteins expressed in the right sets of cells in the human brain. And that's essentially a challenge that's faced by many kinds of gene therapy approaches. But it's not an insurmountable challenge. Many people are working on this problem, and there's a possibility that with the use of appropriate viruses, we can get these proteins to their targets in the right brain area, in the right sets of cells.
Okay, so that instead of treating somebody with Parkinson's disease by perhaps going in with an electrode, we might either go in with a virus to carry in these protein switches or perhaps implant cells that have been genetically engineered. Is that the kind of thinking?
That's right, exactly.
But I presume that's years down the road?
It's still years off, but people are working hard on the technical problems that are going to need to be solved to make this work.
When you think of a worm where you can kind of control its movement just by shining light on it, it's very much like the kind of brain control that you might read about in science fiction. I presume that is science fiction, isn't it, that kind of brain control?
Well, certainly the authors have shown that you can very elegantly and very precisely control the movement of worms. And the next step now is to show that we can control more complicated behaviors in more complex nervous systems. So one of the dreams of neuroscientists is to try and solve the neural code, by which they mean the temporal and spatial pattern of activity that's required to generate particular sets of behavior. And what this new tool allows us to do is to actually directly control the pattern of activity in specific sets of cells in different parts of the brain, and therefore to directly manipulate the neurons that we think might be responsible for certain kinds of behavior. So it really opens up a whole set of new experiments which allow us to link the activity of groups of cells with specific kinds of behavior.
Dr. Michael Heuser of University College London, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Now, still to come, election campaigning on the web and where to go whale watching this weekend. But first, this. Now, what's the connection between that great Mike Oldfield classic 1973 rock album Tubular Bells, military submarines and prospecting for water? Well, the answer lies in some intriguing physics, as I learned from geophysicist George Reynolds when I joined him in a field to go prospecting for water.
Most water, groundwater, is trapped in rocks, in pores and joints and cracks and so on. In Ireland, it's mostly in fracture zones or fault zones, if you like. These are zones of broken up rock, and the water basically just seeps into them. And a lot of water wells in Ireland are based, are found rather, in this type of situation.
You've got a big case, a hard case of high-tech equipment here. What have you got?
Well, there's various ways of finding water, but the thing is, it changes the electrical conductivity of the rocks that it's in. And there's ways you can measure that, but the way I prefer to go with first is using radio signals. And I use this instrument here, which is basically a radio receiver.
Switch that on for me, can you? Now so that's a big radio receiver, yeah, you have in your hand. And what signal are you picking up there?
Well, I'm picking up a transmitter in Cumbria, which works in the VLF band, which is actually below the long wave band. If you tune in RTE, or what used to be Atlantic 252, you're on the long wave band at 252 kilohertz. But I'm down at 20 or 22 kilohertz.
So it's very low frequency.
Very low frequency, yeah.
And how do very low frequency radio waves help you locate water?
Well, they discovered quite early in the 1930s that radio signals penetrate the ground. And if you've ever listened to the radio while going into a tunnel, you notice that it fades away very quickly, and then as you come out of the tunnel, it comes back again. But at VLF frequencies, it penetrates the ground much more than that, maybe tens of metres, whereas, say, RT on media wave would only penetrate maybe a metre or two into the ground.
Do you want to take up your radio transmitter here? I mean, are we going to find water here walking around in the open air here?
What
would we hear if we did?
Well, not from a single measurement, because you can see I'm holding the instrument horizontally. There's an antenna, and it's in the maximum position when the sound is loudest. And when I'm pointing it towards the transmitter, it's in the minimum position. So I would have to take a series of measurements, rotating the instrument perpendicular to the signal. And I would walk along a line taking measurements maybe every 10 metres. And what I'm measuring is the tilt of the signal. And normally when there's nothing in the background, it's horizontal. If you were out in a boat on the sea, the signal would be horizontal. But when there's something in the ground conductive, it acts like a secondary antenna and the signal is actually tilted. So I'm looking at what's called the wave tilt and the polarisation of the radio signal.
So you're building up a three-dimensional picture.
So I have to build up a 3D picture
by
taking lines of readings.
By water that's there.
Yeah.
Okay, so now the next question is, where are these signals coming from? What are these transmitters?
Not long after Marconi's time, they discovered that to communicate with colonies, say the British colonies or the German ones or the French ones, the only way to do it before they invented shortwave was to use VLF and loads of power. And that would certainly reach to the colonies, to Africa and places like that. So there's a sprinkling of these stations around the world. But then when shortwave came in, their raison d'etre sort of disappeared. But then they got a revival in terms of time signals. But then it was discovered that as these signals also penetrate seawater, you could communicate to submarines without the submarine having to surface. Any other form of communication, the submarine would have to surface and give away its position, perhaps. So at the moment, they're used, and although it's well known but not very well publicised, is that they communicate with submerged submarines and possibly to give them information, either navigation or meteorological information or maybe even where to launch or when and where to launch their missiles.
So the signal you're picking up could be some communication between a transmitter or is somewhere in Britain, is it, we're listening to?
Yes, that one is in Britain. There's one in Norway, there's one in Germany, there's one in France. There was one in Germany up to World War II, but the Russians took it away and set it up in Moscow. But 1 week after the fall of communism, the fall of the Soviet Empire, if you like, or the Soviet Union, it went off the air. And we think they weren't paying their electricity bills. Because these things are very inefficient. They use vast amounts of electricity for a very small output in terms of radio signal.
And the signal that you're picking up, are we actually eavesdropping on communications with submarines there?
Yes. Years ago we used to pick up Morse code. We could actually hear the Morse code at high speed. But now they have a system called MSK, or multiple shift keying. And I can let you hear a sample of that now coming from the transmitter.
It's an intriguing whistling sound, isn't it?
It is, and people think I'm communicating with UFOs when they hear me, but I have another instrument which doesn't make any sound. It's a newer, more modern one, but it's actually heavier, and it doesn't work too well in the vicinity of buildings and power lines, so sometimes I prefer to use the old one.
Okay, that's prospecting for water and communicating with submarines. Mike Oldfield's tubular bells, where does that come into all of this?
Yes, well, this was a strange thing. The transmitter in Rugby was demolished a few years ago in 2003, I think to make way for development, housing development, and replaced by the ones in Cumbria. But the thing about it was, it wasn't very far away from the Manor Studios in Oxford. And when they recorded tubular bells in that studio, without realising it, they picked up the signal from the transmitter at Rugby. And some friend of mine in Germany actually noticed this, and now it's sort of common knowledge.
And is that audible on the recording of tubular bells?
No, it's not. The signal was at 16 kilohertz, which is probably within the range of hearing of teenagers. And you've probably heard about this mosquito device for keeping teenagers away. I can't hear it, but I think it's very low level compared to the rest of the recording level of the music. So the only way you can see it is by doing a frequency analysis of the signal. And if you look at this one
and
here...
here's one you prepared earlier.
This is the first 7 or 6 or 7 seconds of tubular bells.
And this is just a piece of software that displays the audio signals in it. Is it? We're looking at a laptop screen
here.
Yes,
we're looking at a very cheap and simple software that's actually used for looking at frequencies, the frequency spectrum of animal sounds, bats included. And it's very similar, and a lot of people use this for zoology.
And it's a lovely image, and just so that people know what we're looking at, we'll put the image up on our website.
Now, what you can see here is a frequency spectrum. This is time going this way, 6 seconds, and this is frequency. And up at the top at 16,000 hertz, which is the frequency of the Rugby transmitter, you'll see a series of dots and dashes. I've actually converted them down to audible sounds, so you can hear that as well. Yeah, that's the Morse converted. And what you heard there was the letter V three times, followed by the call sign G, B and R. And everyone knows Morse, the Morse code for V, or victory, because it's the opening passage of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Dot, 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 dash. Dot, 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 dot. And it's repeated three times. That's to get the attention of the operator. A sequence of Vs just makes the operator realise that something is coming.
Okay, so VVV, and then the next
three
would GBR. Then
the call sign GBR to identify the transmitter, and they all have their own names, three-letter names. And then this continues on and on and on, and somewhere in the middle of Tubular Bells, a message appears. But we couldn't find it because the file was too big and there was a lot of work trying to find it. We don't know what it was anyway.
So if anyone finds it, let us know.
But this was a nice remnant, or a nice memory, if you like, souvenir of the old GBR transmitter. Still embedded in Michael Oldfield's music.
Can people pick that up if they have a copy of Tubular Bells at home?
Yes, it would have to be on CD because the MP3 files compress the high frequencies and you lose the GBR signal. But on a good quality CD and with this very 40 euro software, anybody can analyse their music tracks and see this.
Now, of all the items we've done in this series, I think that was the most intriguing one I've come across. And our thanks to consultant geophysicist George Reynolds for that intriguing story. And if you click to our website, you can see the wave analysis that George was talking about, and it shows the Morse code signal at the start of Tubular Bells. Very good. Now, campaigning is already underway for the general election, even though the date hasn't been announced yet. One thing is sure, there'll be no electronic voting this time, but will there be electronic campaigning? Will our politicians and our wannabe politicians get with the times and run their campaign on the internet? Well, one Irish enterprise called Bigulow thinks that if election candidates want to reach the younger voters, then the only way is to use Bebo, the social networking website. And on the phone is Des Traynor of Bigulow.com, and I gather Bigulow, it's a kind of a search engine for Bebo, is it, Des?
Precisely, yeah. If you want to find friends or people in your area, you can use Bigulow and you'll find their Bebo pages.
Okay, but what is Bebo for the uninitiated?
Okay, so Bebo is what's called a social network. What it is it allows people to very simply set up their own website and they can connect to their friends or colleagues through Bebo by adding them as friends or alternatively selecting which schools or which workplaces they're in, and as a result Bebo will automatically forge a connection.
Okay, so it's kind of circles of friends and acquaintances. Now, I've seen one survey that says that it's something like 70%, that's over two-thirds of people aged 16 to 25, actually spend over an hour a day on Bebo. So it's clearly popular with young people, many of whom probably never voted before in a general election. But why would Bebo be useful for politicians?
I think it would be very useful for politicians because young people, I think, are far more comfortable discussing things over the new mediums such as Bebo. And the likes of, say, text messaging are far more important to young people. I think they're more likely to air their views and opinions over a sort of network such as Bebo, as opposed to, say, talking to a politician on their doorstep.
I presume it would also be cheaper for a politician than printing off lots of flyers.
Massively so, yes, definitely. Mm.
But would a blog not be more useful as a campaign tool for a politician?
Well, a blog is definitely a step up from what's there at the moment. But the problem with a blog is it's a standalone website. So when... If you don't, there's no connection between the necessary connection between blogs. So if a politician sets up a blog, they're relying on young people going along to their blog and reading it, which probably isn't going to happen, just like in the same way they won't read the Irish Times to find out about politicians' opinions. Whereas with Bebo, if the politician has left them a comment or maybe forged a friend relationship, they will actually automatically get updated with things that the politician is saying. So it's kind of a much more interactive medium than a blog.
More interactive and interconnected. Are there any politicians or candidates at the moment who are using Bebo to good effect? I mean, do you want to name and praise anyone?
I could say there's a couple that we've mentioned before, Lucinda Creighton for Fine Gael, and actually most of the Fine Gael party seems to be, it must have come in from the top, but the majority of the Fine Gael party seems to have Bebo pages where they actually actively maintain them and do post things like mainly local issues. I think they are making a good effort to target young voters because they're not discussing sort of things like the budget or whatever. They're discussing sort of practical, pragmatic things that the average 18-year-old might care about, such as, do we need a pedestrian walkway over this road? Or, you know, would you like more police in your area? That sort of stuff. Like, they sort of seem to be targeting young people with what they're doing through Bebo.
What about the problem of phony Bebo sites? Because I had a look there earlier today and all I could find were actually the phony ones, phony Bertie Ahern pages and yeah. Michael McDougall.
Yeah, that's a problem. I think, you know, when you sort of get that popular, people are inevitably going to want to like take a stab at you in some way, shape, or form. So yeah, there is phony Bebocite. I have no doubt that if Bertie Hearn did actually have a legitimate Bebocite, it would outrank all of those. Maybe it might not be as funny, but people will definitely come along and have a look at it. But yeah, phony Bebocites are... they're a reality. I think everyone who has any sort of celebrity status has to deal with them.
Okay, the downside of fame. But as you say, if Bertie had a real one, then that would be one way of dealing with it. Finally, now, you've set up a particular election site, election.bigelow.com. Is this for politicians or for voters or for both?
It's kind of for both. It's, I suppose, for politicians to realise that what they're missing out on to an extent, because hopefully maybe politicians will come along. They'll view the sort of legitimate sites that we have sort of found, and they'll see that how it's working for certain politicians, and maybe they'll decide to get on board before it's too late. Certainly for younger voters, it seems to be very popular with younger voters, just judging by our traffic, but what we're seeing is that like an awful lot of people are for the first time, like, you know, age 18 or 19, finding out who is running for government in their area.
Okay, and you've also, I think, linked it up to Google Maps so that people can actually go from their own region and find who's local there. Are we just catching up with the states on this? Is the US ahead of us? Are they already doing it there?
Well, if you look at the last elections in America, yeah, new media, like sort of what they call citizen journalism, played a huge role in the US elections. I think sites like YouTube had all the party political broadcasts, then actually independent journalists were then going and sort of, you know, they'd take a certain politician and show how he's contradicted himself over the duration of his sort of campaign. And, you know, I think, yeah, like definitely new media has played a huge role in the outcome of the recent elections in America. It makes the information that people might not necessarily otherwise have time to digest, people are putting it up there and it's spreading like virally across the net. So as a result, I think it does have a huge impact, definitely more so than traditional campaigning.
Okay, we'll be watching it with interest when the election campaign starts in earnest here. Des Traynor of Bigelow.com, thank you. And we'll put a link to that election site from our programme website.
Thank you very much.
Time now for our weekly look at the natural world. And the first minke whales of the year were recently seen in Irish waters. Well, joining me on the line from West Cork is Padraig Cooley, who's spokesperson for the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. Padraig, what was seen and where?
Yeah, a number of observers watched two minke whales feeding just west of the old Head of Kinsale last week, which is great. And minke whales are a species that generally we would associate with summer and autumn time, but start arriving at this time of the year, which kind of coincides maybe with water temperatures beginning to heat up. Whereas our really big whales, like the fin whales, they've now left Irish waters and we're probably not going to start seeing them until late May, early June. So it's amazing because for much of the year we have whale and dolphin activity, but this is probably the low season. But hopefully we're beginning to see, with the arrival now of the minke whales, we're beginning to see things heating up, as they say.
Okay, so apart from minke whales, if somebody was to go whale watching at the weekend, what might they see?
Yeah, well, of course, the weather is forecast to be excellent with extremely light winds, which is what people want. But, I mean, the most commonly seen species of cetacean is always going to be the harbour porpoise. And they are very much widespread in distribution. Along the west coast at the moment, there's been really strong showings of bottlenose dolphins in the Shannon Estuary, of course, where they're resident, but also along the North Clare coast and Galway. So if you're in that area, keep an eye out for the impressive pods of bottlenose dolphins, which people have been seeing in the last couple of weeks. So really, whale watching, as always, is kind of a question of being in the right place at the right time. But you've got the superb weather conditions coming up, flat calm sea. So what we'd say, as always, is bring your binoculars, sit up on the headlands and watch. And of course, let the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group know what you've seen.
Excellent. So sit up on a headland with a bit of height to give you some chance of seeing something. That's excellent. Padraig Cooley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in the programme on our website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum, where you'll also find contact details for the programme. But until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte.